Part 8, Chapter 1. Almost 2 months had passed. The hot summer was half over, but Sergei Ivanovich Koznishev was only just preparing to leave Moscow. Sergei Ivanovich's life hadn't been uneventful during this time. A year ago, he had finished his book, The Fruit of 6 Years' Labor, Sketch of a Survey of the Principles and Forms of Government in Europe and Russia. Several sections of this book and its introduction had appeared in periodicals, and other parts had been read by Sergei Ivanovich to persons of his circle, so that the major ideas of the work couldn't be completely novel to the public. But still, Sergei Ivanovich had expected that on its appearance his book would be sure to make a serious impression on society, and if it didn't cause a revolution in social science, it would, at any rate, make a great stir in the scientific world. After the most conscientious revision, the book had last year been published, and had been distributed among the booksellers. Though he asked no one about it, reluctantly, and with feigned indifference answered his friends' inquiries as to how the book was going, and didn't even inquire of the booksellers how the book was selling, Sergei Ivanovich watched eagerly, with strained attention, for the first impression his book would make in the world and in literature. But a week passed, a second, a third, and in society no impression whatever could be detected. His friends, who were specialists and scholars occasionally, unmistakably from politeness, alluded to it. The rest of his acquaintances, not interested in a book on a learned subject, didn't talk of it at all. And society generally, just now especially absorbed in other things, was absolutely indifferent. In the press, too, for a whole month, there wasn't a word about his book. Sergei Ivanovich had calculated to a nicety the time necessary for writing a review, but a month passed, and a second, and still there was silence. Only in the Northern Beetle, in a comic article on the singer Drabanti, who had lost his voice, was there a contemptuous allusion to Koznishev's book, suggesting that the book had been long ago seen through by everyone, and was a subject of general ridicule. At last, in the third month, a critical article appeared in a serious review. Sergei Ivanovich knew the author of the article. He had met him once at Golubtsov's. The author of the article was a young, sickly man, very bold as a writer, but extremely deficient in reading and shy in personal relations. In spite of his absolute contempt for the author, it was with complete respect that Sergei Ivanovich set about reading the article. The article was terrible. The critic had undoubtedly put an interpretation upon the book which couldn't possibly be put on it. But he had selected quotations so adroitly that for people who hadn't read the book, and obviously scarcely anyone had read it, it seemed absolutely clear that the whole book was nothing but a medley of high-flown phrases, not even, as suggested by marks of interrogation, used appropriately, and that the author of the book was a person absolutely without knowledge of the subject. And all this was so wittily done that Sergei Ivanovich wouldn't have disowned such wit himself. But that was just what was so terrible. In spite of the scrupulous conscientiousness with which Sergei Ivanovich verified the correctness of the critic's arguments, he didn't for a minute stop to ponder over the faults and mistakes that were ridiculed. But unconsciously, he began immediately trying to recall every detail of his meeting and conversation with the author of the article. "Didn't I offend him in some way?" Sergei Ivanovich wondered. And remembering that when they had met, he had corrected the young man about something he had said that betrayed ignorance, Sergei Ivanovich found the clue to explain the article. This article was followed by a deadly silence about the book, both in the press and in conversation, and Sergei Ivanovich saw that his 6 years' task, toiled at with such love and labour, had gone, leaving no trace. Sergei Ivanovich's position was still more difficult, owing to the fact that since he had finished his book, he had had no more literary work to do, such as had hitherto occupied the greater part of his time. Sergei Ivanovich was clever, cultivated, healthy, and energetic, and he didn't know what use to make of his energy. Conversations in drawing-rooms, in meetings, assemblies, and committees, everywhere where talk was possible, took up part of his time. But being used to town life for years, he didn't waste all his energies in talk, as his less experienced younger brother did when he was in Moscow. He had a great deal of leisure and intellectual energy still to dispose of. Fortunately for him, at this difficult period following the failure of his book, the various public questions of the dissenting sects, of the American Alliance, of the Samara Famine, of exhibitions, and of spiritualism were definitely replaced in public interest by the Slavonic question, which had hitherto rather languidly interested society, and Sergei Ivanovitch, who had been one of the first to raise this subject, threw himself into it heart and soul. In the circle to which Sergei Ivanovitch belonged, nothing was talked of or written about just now but the Serbian war. Everything that the idle crowd usually does to kill time was done now for the benefit of the Slavonic states. Balls, concerts, dinners, speeches, fashion, beer, restaurants, everything testified to sympathy with the Slavic peoples. From much of what was spoken and written on the subject, Sergei Ivanovitch differed on various points. He saw that the Slavic question had become one of those fashionable distractions which succeeded one another in providing society with an object and an occupation. He saw, too, that a great many people were taking up the subject from motives of self-interest and self-advertisement. He recognized that the newspapers published a great deal that was superfluous and exaggerated, with the sole aim of attracting attention and outcrying one another. He saw that in this general movement, those who thrust themselves forward the most and shouted the loudest were men who had failed and were smarting under a sense of injury. Generals without armies, ministers not in the ministry, journalists not on any paper, party leaders without followers. He saw that there was a great deal in it that was frivolous and absurd, but he also recognized an unmistakable growing enthusiasm uniting all classes with which it was impossible not to sympathize. The massacre of Slavs who were fellow Christians and Slav brethren excited sympathy for the sufferers and indignation against the oppressors. And the heroism of the Serbians and Montenegrins, struggling for a great cause, begot in the whole people a longing to help their brothers, not in word, but in deed. But in this there was another aspect that rejoiced Sergei Ivanovitch. That was the manifestation of public opinion. The public had definitely expressed its desire. The soul of the people had, as Sergei Ivanovitch said, found expression. And the more he worked in this cause, the more incontestable it seemed to him that it was a cause destined to assume vast dimensions, to create an epoch in Russian history. He threw himself heart and soul into the service of this great cause, and forgot to think about his book. His whole time now was engrossed by it, so that he could scarcely manage to answer all the letters and appeals addressed to him. He worked the whole spring and part of the summer, and it was only in July that he prepared to go away to his brothers in the country. He was going both to rest for 2 weeks, and in the sacred heart of the nation, in the farthest depths of the country, to enjoy the sight of that uprising of the natural spirit of which, like all residents in the capital and large cities, he was fully convinced. Katavasov had long been meaning to carry out his promise to stay with Levin, and so he was going with him. Chapter 2 Sergei Ivanovitch and Katavasov had only just reached the Kursky station, which was particularly busy and full of people that day, when, looking round for the footman who was following with their things, they saw a party of volunteers driving up in 4 cabs. Ladies met them with bouquets of flowers, and followed by the rushing crowd, they went into the station. One of the ladies who had met the volunteers came out of the hall and addressed Sergei Ivanovitch.
"You two come to see them off?" she asked in French.
"No. I'm going away myself, princess, to my brother's for a holiday."
"Do you always see them off?" said Sergei Ivanovitch with a hardly perceptible smile.
"Oh, that would be impossible," answered the princess. "Is it true that 800 have been sent from us already? Malvinsky wouldn't believe me."
"More than 800. If you count those who've been sent not directly from Moscow, over 1,000." "'Answered Sergei Ivanovitch.
"There! That's just what I said!" exclaimed the lady. "And it's true, too, I suppose, that more than 1,000,000 has been subscribed?"
"Yes, princess."
"What do you say to today's telegram? Beaten the Turks again?"
"Yes, so I saw," Sergei Ivanovitch answered.
They were speaking of the last telegram, stating that the Turks had been beaten for 3 days in succession at all points and put to flight, and that tomorrow a decisive engagement was expected.
Ah, by the way, a splendid young fellow has asked leave to go, and they've made some difficulty. I don't know why.
I meant to ask you.
I know him. Please write a note about his case. He's being sent by Countess Lydia Ivanovna.
Sergei Ivanovitch asked for all the details the princess knew about the young man, and going into the first-class waiting room, he wrote a note to the proper authorities and handed it to the princess.
You know Count Vronsky, the notorious... is going by this train, said the princess, with a smile full of triumph and meaning, when he found her again and gave her the letter.
I heard he was going, but I didn't know when. By this train.
I've seen him. He's here.
There's only his mother seeing him off.
It's the best thing, anyway, that he could do.
Oh, yes, of course. While they were talking, the crowd streamed by them into the restaurant. They went forward, too, and heard a gentleman, with a glass in his hand, delivering a loud discourse to the volunteers.
In the service of religion, humanity, and our brothers, the gentleman said, his voice growing louder and louder, to this great cause, Mother Moscow dedicates you with her blessing. Živio! He concluded, loudly and tearfully.
Everyone shouted, Živio! And a fresh crowd dashed into the hall, almost carrying the princess off her legs.
Ah, princess, that was something, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, suddenly appearing in the middle of the crowd and beaming upon them with a delighted smile. Wonderfully, warmly said, wasn't it? Bravo! And Sergei Ivanovitch, why, you ought to have said something. Just a few words, you know, to encourage them. You do that so well, he added, with a soft, respectful, and discreet smile, moving Sergei Ivanovitch forward a little by the arm. No, I'm just off.
Where to?
To the country, to my brothers, answered Sergei Ivanovitch. Then you'll see my wife. I've written to her, but you'll see her first. Please tell her that you've seen me, and that it's all right, as the English say. She'll understand.
Oh, and be so good as to tell her I'm appointed secretary of the committee.
But she'll understand, you know, the small miseries of human life,
he said, as if apologizing to the princess.
And Princess Miakaya, not Lisa, but Bibish, is sending 1,000 rifles and 12 nurses, did I tell you?
Yes, I heard, Koznishev answered indifferently.
It's a pity you're going away, said Stepan Arkadyevitch. Tomorrow we're giving a dinner to two who are setting off. Dima Batnyansky from Petersburg and our Veslovsky, Grisha. They're both going. Veslovsky's only lately married. There's a fine fellow for you, eh, princess?
He said, turning to the lady. The princess looked at Koznishev without replying. But the fact that Sergei Ivanovitch and the princess seemed anxious to get rid of him didn't in the least disconcert Stepan Arkadyevitch. Smiling, he stared at the feather in the princess's hat, and then about him, as though he was going to pick something up. Seeing a lady approaching with a collection box, he beckoned to her and put in a 5-ruble note.
I can never see these collection boxes unmoved while I've money in my pocket, he said. And how about today's telegram? Fine fellows, those Montenegrins.
You don't say so,
he cried, when the princess told him that Vronsky was going by this train. For an instant, Stepan Arkadyevitch's face looked sad, but a minute later, when smoothing his whiskers and with a spring in his walk, he went into the hall where Vronsky was, he had completely forgotten his own despairing sobs over his sister's corpse, and he saw in Vronsky only a hero and an old friend.
With all his faults, one can't refuse to do him justice, said the princess to Sergei Ivanovitch as soon as Stepan Arkadyevitch had left them. What a typically Russian Slav nature! Only, I'm afraid it won't be pleasant for Vronsky to see him. Say what you will, I'm touched by that man's fate. Do talk to him a little on the way, said the princess.
Yes, perhaps, if it happens so. I never liked him, but this atones for a great deal.
He's not merely going himself. He's taking a squadron at his own expense.
Yes, so I heard.
A bell sounded. Everyone crowded to the doors.
"Here he is," said the princess, indicating Vronsky,
who, with his mother on his arm, walked by, wearing a long overcoat and wide-brimmed black hat. Oblonsky was walking beside him, talking eagerly of something. Vronsky was frowning and looking straight before him, as though he didn't hear what Stepan Arkadyevitch was saying. Probably, on Oblonsky's pointing them out, he looked around in the direction where the princess and Sergei Ivanovitch were standing, and without speaking, he lifted his hat. His face, aged and worn by suffering, looked stony. Going to the platform, Vronsky left his mother and disappeared into a compartment. On the platform there rang out, "God save the Tsar!" and then shouts of, "Hurrah!" and "Zhivyo!" One of the volunteers, a tall, very young man with a hollow chest, was particularly conspicuous, bowing and waving his felt hat and a bouquet over his head. From behind him, two officers emerged, and an elderly man with a big beard, wearing a greasy cap, and they bowed. Chapter 3 Saying goodbye to the princess, Sergei Ivanovitch was joined by Katavasov. Together they got into a carriage full to overflowing, and the train started. At Tsaritsino station, the train was met by a chorus of young men singing Slavsha. Again the volunteers bowed and poked their heads out, but Sergei Ivanovitch paid no attention to them. He had had so much to do with the volunteers that the type was familiar to him and didn't interest him. Katavasov, whose scientific work had prevented his having a chance of observing them hitherto, was very much interested in them and questioned Sergei Ivanovitch. Sergei Ivanovitch advised him to go into the second-class carriage and talk to them himself. At the next station, Katavasov acted on this suggestion. At the first stop, he moved into the second class and made the acquaintance of the volunteers. They were sitting in a corner of the carriage, talking loudly, and obviously aware that the attention of the passengers and Katavasov, as he got in, was concentrated upon them. More loudly than all talked the tall, hollow-chested young man. He was unmistakably tipsy, and was relating some story that had occurred at his school. Facing him sat a middle-aged officer, wearing the military jacket of the Austrian Guards. He was listening with a smile to the hollow-chested youth, and tried to stop him. The third, in an artillery uniform, was sitting on a trunk beside them. A fourth was asleep. Entering into conversation with the youth, Katavasov learned that he was a wealthy Moscow merchant who had run through a large fortune before he was 22. Katavasov didn't like him, because he was effeminate and spoiled and sickly. He was obviously convinced, especially now after drinking, that he was performing a heroic action, and he bragged of it in the most unpleasant way. The second, the retired officer, made an unpleasant impression too upon Katavasov. He was, it seemed, a man who had tried everything. He had been on a railway, had been a steward on an estate, and had started factories, and he talked, quite without necessity, of all he had done, and used learned expressions quite inappropriately. The third, the artilleryman, on the contrary, struck Katavasov very favourably. He was a quiet, modest fellow, unmistakably impressed by the knowledge of the officer and the heroic self-sacrifice of the merchant, and saying nothing about himself. When Katavasov asked him what had impelled him to go to Serbia, he answered modestly, "Oh, well, everyone's going. The Serbians need help, too. I'm sorry for them." "Yes, you artillerymen especially are scarce there," said Katavasov. "Oh, I wasn't in the artillery long. Maybe they'll put me into the infantry or the cavalry." "Into the infantry when they need artillery more than anything?" said Katavasov, concluding from the artilleryman's apparent age that he must have reached a fairly high grade. "I wasn't in the artillery long. I'm a retired cadet," he said, and he began to explain how he had failed in his examination. All of this together made a disagreeable impression on Katavasov, and when the volunteers got out at a station for a drink, Katavasov would have liked to compare his unfavourable impression in conversation with someone. There was an old man in the carriage, wearing a military overcoat, who'd been listening all the while to Katavasov's conversation with the volunteers. When they were left alone, Katavasov addressed him.
"What different positions they come from, all those fellows who are going off there.
Katavasov said vaguely, not wishing to express his own opinion, and at the same time anxious to find out the old man's views. The old man was an officer who had served in 2 campaigns. He knew what makes a soldier, and judging by the appearance and the talk of those persons, by the swagger with which they had recourse to the bottle on the journey, he considered them poor soldiers. Moreover, he lived in a district town, and he was longing to tell how one soldier had volunteered from his town, a drunkard and a thief whom no one would employ as a labourer. But knowing from experience that in the present condition of the public temper it was dangerous to express an opinion opposed to the general one, and especially to criticise the volunteers unfavourably, he watched Katavasov without committing himself.
"Well, men are needed there," he said, laughing with his eyes.
And they began talking of the latest war news, and each concealed from the other his perplexity as to the engagement expected the next day, since the Turks had been beaten, according to the latest news, at all points. And so they parted, neither giving expression to his opinion. Katavasov went back to his own carriage, and with reluctant prevarication reported to Sergei Ivanovitch his observations of the volunteers, from which it would appear that they were excellent fellows. At the next big station, the volunteers were again greeted with shouts and singing. Again men and women with collection boxes appeared, and provincial ladies brought bouquets to the volunteers and followed them into the refreshment room. But all this was on a much smaller and feebler scale than in Moscow. Chapter 4. While the train was stopping at the provincial town, Sergei Ivanovitch didn't go to the refreshment room, but walked up and down the platform. The first time he passed Vronsky's compartment, he noticed that the curtain was drawn over the window. But as he passed it the second time, he saw the old countess at the window. She beckoned to Koznishev.
"I'm going, you see, taking him as far as Kursk," she said.
"Yes, so I heard," said Sergei Ivanovitch, standing at her window and looking in. "What a noble act on his part," he added, noticing that Vronsky wasn't in the compartment.
"Yes. Well, after his misfortune, what was there for him to do?"
"What a terrible thing it was," said Sergei Ivanovitch.
"Ah, but what I have been through. But do get in. Oh, what I have been through," she repeated, when Sergei Ivanovitch had got in and sat down beside her. "You can't conceive it. For 6 weeks he didn't speak to anyone, and wouldn't touch food except when I implored him. And not for 1 minute could we leave him alone. We took away everything he could have used against himself. We lived on the ground floor, but there was no counting on anything."
"You know, of course, that he had shot himself once already on her account," she said, and the old lady's eyelashes twitched at the recollection.
"Yes, hers was the fitting end for such a woman. Even the death she chose was coarse and vulgar."
"It's not for us to judge, Countess," said Sergei Ivanovitch. "But I can understand that it has been very hard for you."
"Oh, don't speak of it. I was staying on my estate, and he was with me. A note was brought him. He wrote an answer and sent it off. We hadn't an idea that he was close by at the station. In the evening I'd only just gone to my room when my Maria told me a lady had thrown herself under the train. Something seemed to strike me at once. I knew it was she. The first thing I said was he wasn't to be told. But they'd told him already. His coachman was there and saw it all. When I ran into his room, he was beside himself. It was fearful to see him. He didn't say a word, but galloped off to the station. I don't know to this day what happened there, but he was brought back at death's door. I wouldn't have known him. Complete prostration, the doctor said. And that was followed almost by madness." "Oh, why talk of it?" said the Countess with a wave of her hand. "It was an awful time. No, say what you will, she was a bad woman. Why, what is the meaning of such desperate passion? It was all to prove something extraordinary. Well, and that she did do. She brought herself to ruin, and 2 good men, her husband and my unhappy son."
"And what did her husband do?" asked Sergei Ivanovitch.
"He took her daughter. Aloysia was ready to agree to anything at first. Now it worries him terribly that he should have given his own child away to another man.
But he can't take back his word. Karenin came to the funeral.
But we tried to prevent his meeting Aloysia.
For him, for her husband. It was easier anyway. She had set him free. But my poor son was utterly given up to her. He had thrown up everything. His career. Me. And even then she had no mercy on him, but deliberately made his ruin complete. No, say what you will. Her very death was the death of a vile woman of no religious feeling. God forgive me, but I can't help hating the memory of her when I look at my son's misery.
But how is he now?
It was a blessing from Providence for us, this Serbian war. I'm old, and I don't understand the rights and wrongs of it. But it's come as a providential blessing to him. Of course, for me, as his mother, it's terrible. And what's worse, they say, it's not favourably regarded in Petersburg. But it can't be helped. It was the one thing that could rouse him. Yashvin, a friend of his, he'd lost all he had at cards, and he was going to Serbia. He came to see him and persuaded him to go. Now it's an interest for him. Do please talk to him a little. I want to distract his mind. He's so miserable. And as bad luck would have it, he has a toothache too. But he'll be delighted to see you. Please do talk to him. He's walking up and down on that side.
Sergei Ivanovitch said he would be very glad to, and crossed over to the other side of the station. Chapter 5. In the slanting evening shadows cast by sacks piled up on the platform, Vronsky, in his long overcoat and slouch hat, with his hands in his pockets, strode up and down like a wild beast in a cage, turning sharply after 20 paces. Sergei Ivanovitch thought, as he approached him, that Vronsky saw him, but was pretending not to. This didn't affect Sergei Ivanovitch in the slightest. He was above all personal considerations with Vronsky. At that moment, Sergei Ivanovitch looked upon Vronsky as a man taking an important part in a great cause, and thought it his duty to encourage him and express his approval. He went up to him. Vronsky stood still, looking intently at him, recognized him, and going a few steps forward to meet him, shook hands with him very warmly.
"Possibly you didn't wish to see me," said Sergei Ivanovitch, "but couldn't I be of use to you?"
"There's no one I would less dislike seeing than you," said Vronsky.
"Forgive me, but there's nothing in life for me to like."
"I quite understand, and I merely meant to offer you my services," said Sergei Ivanovitch, scanning Vronsky's face full of unmistakable suffering.
"Wouldn't it be of use to you to have a letter to Ristich, to Milan?"
"Oh, no," Vronsky said, seeming to understand him with difficulty. "If you don't mind, let's walk on. It's so stuffy among the carriages. A letter? No, thank you. To meet death, one needs no letters of introduction."
"Nor for the Turks," he said, with a smile that was merely of the lips. His eyes still kept their look of angry suffering.
"Yes, but you might find it easier to establish connections, which are, after all, essential with anyone previously prepared. But as you like. I was very glad to hear of your intention. There have been so many attacks made on the volunteers, and a man like you raises them in the public esteem."
"My use as a man," said Vronsky, "is that life's worth nothing to me. And that I've enough physical energy to hack my way into their ranks, and to trample on them, or fall. I know that. I'm glad there's something to give my life for it's not merely useless, but loathsome to me. Anyone's welcome to it."
And his jaw twitched impatiently from the incessant gnawing toothache which prevented him from even speaking with natural expression.
"You'll become a new man, I predict," said Sergei Ivanovitch, feeling touched. "To deliver one's brothers from bondage is an aim worth death and life. God grant you success outwardly, and inwardly peace," he added, and he held out his hand. Vronsky warmly pressed his outstretched hand.
"Yes, as a weapon I may be of some use. But as a man, I'm a wreck," he said, hesitating between words.
He could hardly speak because of the throbbing ache in his strong teeth, which flooded his mouth with saliva. He was silent, and his eyes rested on the wheels of the tender, slowly and smoothly rolling along the rails.
and all at once a different pain. Not an ache, but a tormenting inner disquiet that set his whole being in anguish, made him for an instant forget his toothache. As he glanced at the tender and the rails, stirred by the conversation he had just had with a friend he hadn't met since his misfortune, he suddenly recalled her, that is, what was left of her, when he had run like one mad into the shed of the railway station. On the table, shamelessly sprawled out among strangers, the blood-stained body so recently full of life, the head unhurt, thrown back with its weight of hair, and the curling tresses about the temples, and the exquisite face with red, half-opened mouth, the strange, frozen expression, piteous on the lips, and awful in the fixed, open eyes, that seemed to utter that fearful phrase she had used when they last quarrelled, that he would be sorry for it. And he tried to think of her as she was when he met her the first time, at a railway station too, mysterious, exquisite, loving, seeking and giving happiness, and not cruelly vengeful as he remembered her that last moment. He tried to recall his best moments with her, but those moments were poisoned forever. He could think of her only as triumphant in having carried out her threat to inflict him with a wholly useless but wholly ineffaceable remorse. He lost all consciousness of toothache, and his face was distorted with sobs. Passing twice up and down beside the sacks in silence, and regaining his self-possession, he addressed Sergei Ivanovitch calmly.
"You don't know of any dispatch since yesterday's?"
"Yes, driven back for a third time. But a decisive engagement is expected for tomorrow." And after talking a little more of the proclamation of Milan as king, and the immense effect it might have, they parted, going to their carriages on hearing the second bell. Chapter 6 Sergei Ivanovitch had not telegraphed his brother to send to meet him, as he didn't know when he would be able to leave Moscow. Levin wasn't at home when Katavasov and Sergei Ivanovitch, in a fly hired at the station, drove up to the steps of the Pokrovskoye house, as black as moors from the dust of the road. Kitty, sitting on the balcony with her father and sister, recognized her brother-in-law and ran down to meet him.
"What a shame not to have let us know," she said, giving her hand to Sergei Ivanovitch, and putting her forehead up for him to kiss.
"We got here easily and haven't put you out," answered Sergei Ivanovitch. "I'm so dirty I'm afraid to touch you. I've been so busy. I didn't know when I'd be able to tear myself away."
"And so you're still as ever enjoying your peaceful, quiet happiness," he said, smiling,
"out of reach of the current in your peaceful backwater. Here's our friend. Fyodor Vasilyevich has succeeded in getting here at last." "But I'm not a moor. I shall look like a human being when I wash," said Katavasov in his jesting fashion, and he shook hands and smiled, his teeth flashing white in his black face.
"Kostya will be delighted. He's gone to the farm. It's time he should be home."
"Busy as ever with his farming. It really is a peaceful backwater," said Katavasov, "while we in town think of nothing but the Serbian war. Well, how does our friend look at it? He's sure not to think like other people."
"Oh, I don't know. Like everybody else," Kitty answered, a little embarrassed, looking around at Sergei Ivanovitch. "I'll send to fetch him. Papa's staying with us. He's only just come home from abroad."
And making arrangements to send for Levin, and for the guests to wash, one in his room and the other in what had been Dolly's, and giving orders for their luncheon, Kitty ran out onto the balcony, enjoying the freedom and rapidity of movement of which she had been deprived during the months of her pregnancy.
"It's Sergei Ivanovitch and Katavasov, a professor," she said.
"Oh, that's too much in this heat," said the prince.
"No, Papa, he's very nice,
and Kostya's very fond of him," Kitty said with a deprecating smile, noticing the irony on her father's face. "Oh, I didn't say anything."
"You go to them, darling," said Kitty to her sister, "and entertain them. They saw Stiva at the station. He was quite well. And I must run to Mitya. I'm afraid I hadn't fed him since breakfast. He's awake now and sure to be screaming."
And feeling the flow of milk, she hurried to the nursery. This was not a mere guess. Her bond with the child was still so close that she could gauge, by the flow of her milk, his need for food, and knew for certain he was hungry.
She knew he was crying before she reached the nursery. And he was indeed crying. She heard him and hastened. But the faster she went, the louder he screamed. It was a fine, healthy scream, hungry and impatient.
"Has he been screaming long, nurse? Very long?" said Kitty, hurriedly, seating herself on the chair and preparing to give the baby the breast. "But give him to me quickly. Oh, nurse, how tiresome you are! There! Tie the cap afterwards!"
The baby was convulsed with hungry yells.
"But you can't manage so, ma'am," said Agafea Mikhailovna, who was almost always to be found in the nursery. "He must be put straight. Oh,
oh!"
she cooed over him, paying no attention to the mother. The nurse brought the baby to his mother. Agafea Mikhailovna followed him with a face dissolving with tenderness.
"He knows me! He knows me! In God's faith, Katerina Alexandrovna, ma'am! He knew me!"
Agafea Mikhailovna cried above the baby's screams. But Kitty didn't hear her words. Her impatience kept growing, like the baby's. Their impatience hindered things for a while. The baby couldn't get hold of the breast right and was furious. At last, after despairing, breathless screaming and vain sucking, things went right, and mother and child felt simultaneously soothed, and both subsided into calm.
"But poor darling, he's all sweaty," said Kitty in a whisper, touching the baby.
"What makes you think he knows you?" she added, with a sidelong glance at the baby's eyes, which peered roguishly, it seemed to her, from under his cap, at his rhythmically puffing cheeks, and at the little rosy palm with which he made circular movements.
"Impossible! If he knew anyone, he would have known me," said Kitty, in response to Agafea Mikhailovna's statement, and she smiled.
She smiled, because though she said he couldn't know her, in her heart she was sure that he knew not merely Agafea Mikhailovna, but knew and understood everything, and knew and understood a great deal, too, that no one else knew, and that she, his mother, had learned and had come to understand only through him. To Agafea Mikhailovna, to the nurse, to his grandfather, to his father, even, Mitya was a living being, requiring only material care. But for his mother, he had long been a mortal being, with whom there had been a whole series of spiritual relations already.
"When he wakes up, please God, you shall see for yourself. Then, when I do like this, he simply beams on me, the darling. Simply beams like a sunny day," said Agafea Mikhailovna.
"Well, well, then we shall see," whispered Kitty. "But now go away. He's going to sleep."
Chapter 7 Agafea Mikhailovna went out on tiptoe. The nurse let down the blind, chased a fly out from under the muslin canopy of the crib, and a bumblebee struggling against the windowpane, and sat down, waving a withered branch of birch over the mother and the baby.
"How hot it is! If God would only send a drop of rain," she said.
"Yes, yes, shh,"
was all Kitty answered, rocking a little, and tenderly squeezing the plump little arm with rolls of fat at the wrist, which Mitya still waved feebly as he opened and shut his eyes. That hand worried Kitty. She longed to kiss it, but was afraid to for fear of waking him. At last the little hand ceased waving, and the eyes closed. Only from time to time, as he went on sucking, the baby raised his long, curly eyelashes, and peeped at his mother with wet eyes that looked black in the twilight. The nurse had stopped fanning and was dozing. From above came the peals of the old prince's voice and the chuckle of Katavasov.
"They got into conversation without me," thought Kitty. "But still, it's vexing that Kostya's out. He's sure to have gone to the apiary again. Though it's a pity he's there so often, still I'm glad. It distracts his mind. He's become altogether happier and better now than in the spring. He used to be so gloomy and worried. I felt frightened for him."
"And how funny he is," she whispered, smiling. She knew what tormented her husband. It was his lack of faith. Although, had she been asked whether she supposed that in the future life, if he didn't believe, he would be damned, she would have had to admit that he would be damned. His lack of faith didn't cause her unhappiness.
and she, confessing that for an unbeliever there could be no salvation, and loving her husband's soul more than anything in the world, thought with a smile of his scepticism, and told herself that he was funny.
"Why does he keep reading philosophy of some sort all this year?" she wondered. "If it's all written in those books, he can understand them. If it's all wrong, why does he read them? He says himself that he would like to believe. Then why is it that he doesn't believe? Because he thinks so much? And he thinks so much from being solitary. He's always alone. Alone. He can't talk about it to us. I imagine he'll be glad of these visitors, especially Katavasov. He likes discussions with them," she thought, and passed instantly to the consideration of where it would be more convenient to put Katavasov, to sleep alone, or to share Sergei Ivanovitch's room. And then an idea suddenly struck her which made her shudder, and even disturb Mitya, who glanced severely at her.
"I do believe the laundress hasn't sent the washing yet, and all the best sheets are in use. If I don't see to it, Agafea Mikhailovna will give Sergei Ivanovitch the wrong sheets." And at the very idea of this, the blood rushed to Kitty's face. "Yes, I will arrange it," she decided. And going back to her former thoughts, she remembered that some spiritual question of importance had been interrupted, and she began to recall what. "Yes, Kostya, an unbeliever," she thought again with a smile. "Well, an unbeliever, then. Better let him always be one than like Madame Stahl, or what I tried to be in those days abroad. No, he won't ever pretend." And a recent instance of his goodness rose vividly to her mind. 2 weeks before, a penitent letter had come from Stepan Arkadyevitch to Dolly. He besought her to save his honour, to sell her estate to pay his debts. Dolly was in despair. She detested her husband, despised him, pitied him, resolved on a separation, resolved to refuse, but ended by agreeing to sell part of her property. After that, with an irrepressible smile of tenderness, Kitty recalled her husband's shame-faced embarrassment, his repeated awkward efforts to approach the subject, and how at last, having thought of the one means of helping Dolly without wounding her pride, he had suggested to Kitty, what had not occurred to her before, that she should give up her share of the property. He, an unbeliever indeed, with his heart, his dread of offending anyone, even a child, everything for others, nothing for himself. Sergei Ivanovitch simply considers it Kostya's duty to be his steward, and it's the same with his sister. Now Dolly and her children are under his guardianship, all those peasants who come to him every day as though he were bound to be at their service. "Yes, only be like your father. Only like him," she said, handing Mitya over to the nurse and putting her lips to his cheek. Chapter 8. Ever since, by his beloved brother's deathbed, Levin had first glanced into the questions of life and death in the light of these new convictions, as he called them, which had, during the period from his 20th to his 34th year, imperceptibly replaced his childish and youthful beliefs, he'd been stricken with horror, not so much of death as of life, without any knowledge of whence and why and how and what it was. The organism, its decay, the indestructibility of matter, the law of the conservation of energy, evolution, were the words that usurped the place of his old belief. These words and the ideas associated with them were very useful for intellectual purposes, but for life they yielded nothing. And Levin felt suddenly like a man who has changed his warm fur cloak for a muslin garment, and going for the first time into the frost, is immediately convinced, not by reason, but by his whole nature, that he is as good as naked, and that he must inevitably perish miserably. From that moment, though he didn't distinctly face it, and still went on living as before, Levin had never lost this sense of terror at his lack of knowledge. He vaguely felt, too, that what he called his new convictions were not merely lack of knowledge, but were part of a whole order of ideas in which no knowledge of what he needed was possible. At first, marriage, with the new joys and duties bound up with it, had completely crowded out these thoughts. But of late, while he was staying in Moscow after his wife's confinement, with nothing to do, the question that clamoured for a solution had more and more often, more and more insistently, haunted Levin's mind. The question was summed up for him thus.
If I do not accept the answers Christianity gives to the problems of my life, what answers do I accept? And in the whole arsenal of his convictions, far from finding any satisfactory answers, he was utterly unable to find anything at all like an answer. He was in the position of a man seeking food in a toy shop or at a gunsmith's. Instinctively, unconsciously, with every book, with every conversation, with every man he met, he was on the lookout for light on these questions and their solution. What puzzled and distracted him above everything was that the majority of men of his age and circle had, like him, exchanged their old beliefs for the same new conditions, and yet saw nothing to lament in this, and were perfectly satisfied and serene. So that apart from the principal question, Levin was tortured by other questions too. Were these people sincere, he asked himself, or were they playing a part? Or was it that they understood the answers science gave to these problems in some different, clearer sense than he did? And he assiduously studied both these men's opinions and the books that treated these scientific explanations. One fact he had found out since these questions had engrossed his mind: he had been quite wrong in supposing, from the recollections of this circle of his young days at college, that religion had outlived its day, and that it was now practically non-existent. All the people near to him, who lived good lives, were believers. The old prince and Ulvov, whom he liked so much, and Sergei Ivanovitch, and all the women believed. And his wife believed as simply as he had believed in his earliest childhood. And 99 hundredths of the Russian people, all the working people for whose life he felt the deepest respect, believed. Another fact of which he became convinced after reading many scientific books was that the men who shared his views didn't surmise anything in those convictions, and that they gave no explanation of the questions which he felt he couldn't live without answering, but simply ignored their existence, and attempted to explain other questions of no possible interest to him, such as the evolution of organisms, a mechanistic explanation of the soul, and so on. Moreover, during his wife's confinement, something had happened that seemed extraordinary to him. He, an unbeliever, had fallen into praying, and at the moment he prayed, he believed. But that moment had passed, and he couldn't make his state of mind at that moment fit into the rest of his life. He couldn't admit that at that moment he knew the truth, and that now he was wrong. For as soon as he began thinking calmly about it, it all fell to pieces. He couldn't admit that he was mistaken then, for his spiritual condition then was precious to him, and to admit that it was proof of weakness would have been to desecrate those moments. He was miserably divided against himself, and strained all his spiritual forces to the utmost to escape from this condition. Chapter 9. These doubts oppressed and tortured him, growing weaker or stronger from time to time, but never leaving him. He read and thought, and the more he read and the more he thought, the further he felt from the aim he was pursuing. Of late, in Moscow and in the country, since he had become convinced that he would find no solution in the materialists, he had read and re-read thoroughly Plato, Spinoza, Kant, Schelling, Hegel, and Schopenhauer, the philosophers who gave a non-materialistic explanation of life. Their ideas seemed to him fruitful when he was reading or was himself seeking arguments to refute other theories, especially those of the materialists. But as soon as he began to read or sought for himself a solution of problems, the same thing always happened. As long as he followed the fixed definition of obscure words such as spirit, will, freedom, substance, purposely letting himself enter the verbal trap set by the philosophers or himself, he seemed to comprehend something. But he had only to forget the artificial train of reasoning, and to turn from life itself to what had satisfied him while thinking in accordance with the fixed definitions, and this artificial edifice fell to pieces at once like a house of cards, and it became clear that the edifice had been built up out of those transposed words, apart from anything in life more important than reason. At one time, reading Schopenhauer, he put in place of his will the word love, and for a couple of days this new philosophy charmed him, till he moved a little away from it. But then, when he turned from life itself to glance at it again, it fell away too, and proved to be the same muslin garment with no warmth in it. Sergei Ivanovitch advised him to read the theological works of Chomyakov. Levin read the second volume of Chomyakov's works, and in spite of the elegant, epigrammatic, argumentative style which at first repelled him, he was impressed by the doctrine of the Church he found in them. He was struck at first by the idea that the apprehension of divine truths had not been vouchsafed to man, but to a corporation of men bound together by love, to the Church. What delighted him was the thought of how much easier it was to believe in a still-existing, living Church, embracing all the beliefs of men, and having God at its head, and therefore holy and infallible, and from it to accept the faith in God, in the creation, the fall, the redemption, than to begin with God, a mysterious, far-away God, the creation, etc. But afterwards, on reading a Catholic writer's history of the Church, and then a Greek Orthodox writer's history of the Church, and seeing that the two churches, in their very conception infallible, each deny the authority of the other, Chomyakov's doctrine of the Church lost all its charm for him, and this edifice crumbled into dust like the philosopher's edifices. All that spring he wasn't himself, and went through fearful moments of horror. "Without knowing what I am and why I'm here, life's impossible, and that I can't know, and so I can't live," Levin said to himself. "In infinite time, in infinite matter, in infinite space is formed a bubble organism, and that bubble lasts a while and bursts, and that bubble is I." It was an agonizing fallacy, but it was the sole logical result of ages of human thought in that direction. This was the ultimate belief, on which all the systems elaborated by human thought, in almost all their ramifications, rested. It was the prevalent conviction, and of all other explanations, Levin had unconsciously, not knowing when or how, chosen it as, at any rate, the clearest, and made it his own. But it was not merely a fallacy. It was the cruel jest of some wicked power, some evil, hateful power, to whom one could not submit. He must escape from this power, and the means of escape every man had in his own hands. He had but to cut short this dependence on evil, and there was one means, death. And Levin, a happy father and husband, in perfect health, was several times so near suicide that he hid a rope so that he might not be tempted to hang himself, and was afraid to go out with his gun for fear of shooting himself. But Levin didn't shoot himself, and didn't hang himself. He went on living. Chapter 10 When Levin thought about what he was and what he was living for, he could find no answer to the questions, and was reduced to despair. But when he ceased questioning himself about it, it seemed as though he knew both what he was and why he was living. For he acted and lived resolutely and without hesitation. Indeed, in these latter days, he was far more decided and unhesitating than he had ever been in his life. When he went back to the country at the beginning of June, he went back also to his usual pursuits. The management of the estate, his relations with the peasants and the neighbours, the care of his household, the management of his sister's and brother's property, of which he had the direction, his relations with his wife and kindred, the care of his child, and the new beekeeping hobby he had taken up that spring filled all his time. These things occupied him now, not because he justified them to himself by any sort of general principles, as he had done in former days. On the contrary, disappointed by the failure of his former efforts for the general welfare, and too much occupied with his own thought and the mass of business with which he was burdened from all sides, he'd completely given up thinking of the general good, and he busied himself with all this work simply because it seemed to him that he must do what he was doing, that he couldn't do otherwise. In former days, almost from childhood and increasingly up to full manhood, when he had tried to do anything that would be good for all, for humanity, for Russia, for his own village, he had noticed that the idea of it had been pleasant, but the work itself had always been clumsy. But then, he had never been fully convinced of its absolute necessity, and that the work that had begun by seeming so great had grown less and less, till it vanished into nothing. But now, since his marriage, when he had begun to confine himself more and more to living for himself, though he experienced no delight at all at the thought of the work he was doing, he felt absolutely convinced of its necessity, saw that it succeeded far better than in the past, and that it kept on growing more and more. Now, involuntarily it seemed, he cut more and more deeply into the soil like a plough, so that he couldn't be drawn out without turning aside the furrow. To live the same family life as his father and forefathers, that is, in the same condition of culture, and so bring up his children, was incontestably necessary. It was as necessary as eating when one was hungry. And to do this, just as it was necessary to cook dinner, it was necessary to keep the Pokrovskoye farmed in such a manner that it would yield profit. Just as incontestably as it was necessary to repay a debt, was it necessary to keep the property in such condition that his son, when he received it as a heritage, would say thank you to his father, as Levin had said thank you to his grandfather, for all he'd built and planted. And to do this, it was necessary to look after the land himself, not to lease it, and to breed cattle, manure the fields, and plant timber. It was impossible not to look after the affairs of Sergei Ivanovitch, of his sister, of the peasants who came to him for advice, and were accustomed to do so, as impossible as to fling down a child one is carrying in one's arms. It was necessary to look after the comfort of his sister-in-law and her children, and of his wife and baby, and it was impossible not to spend with them at least a short time each day. And all this, together with shooting and his new beekeeping, filled up the whole of Levin's life, which had no meaning at all for him when he began to think. But besides knowing thoroughly what he had to do, Levin knew in just the same way how he had to do it all, and what was more important than the rest. He knew he must hire labourers as cheaply as possible, but to hire men in bond, paying them in advance less than the current rate of wages, was what he mustn't do, even though it was very profitable. Selling straw to the peasants in times of scarcity was what he might do, even though he felt sorry for them. But the tavern and the inn must be ignored, though they were a source of income. Stealing timber must be punished as severely as possible, but he couldn't exact fines for cattle being driven onto his fields, and though it annoyed the keeper and made the peasants unafraid to graze their cattle on his land, he couldn't keep their cattle as a punishment. To Pyotr, who was paying a moneylender 10% a month, he must lend a sum of money to set him free. But he couldn't let off peasants who didn't pay their rent, or let them fall into arrears. It was impossible to overlook the bailiffs not having mown the meadows and letting the hay spoil, and it was equally impossible to mow those acres where a young copse had been planted. It was impossible to excuse a labourer who'd gone home in the busy season because his father was dying, however sorry he might feel for him, and he must subtract from his pay those costly months of idleness. But it was impossible not to allow monthly rations to the old servants, who were of no use for anything. Levin knew that when he got home he must first of all go to his wife, who wasn't well, and that the peasants who'd been waiting for 3 hours to see him could wait a little longer. He knew, too, regardless of all the pleasure he felt in hiving a swarm, he must forego that pleasure and leave the old man to tend to the bees alone, while he talked to the peasants who had come after him to the apiary. Whether he was acting rightly or wrongly, he didn't know, and not only would he not try to prove anything nowadays, but he avoided all thought or talk about it. Deliberation had brought him to doubt and prevented him from seeing what he ought to do and what he ought not. When he didn't think, but simply lived, he was continually aware of the presence of an infallible judge in his soul, determining which of two possible courses of action was the better, and which was the worse, and as soon as he didn't act rightly, he was at once aware of it. So he lived, not knowing, and not seeing any chance of knowing what he was and what he was living for, harassed at this lack of knowledge to such a point that he was afraid of suicide, and yet firmly laying down his own individual and definite path in life. Chapter 11. The day on which Sergei Ivanovitch came to Pokrovskoye was one of Levin's most painful days. It was the very busiest season, when all the peasantry show an extraordinary intensity of self-sacrifice in labour, such as is never known in other conditions of life, and would be highly esteemed if the men who showed these qualities themselves thought highly of them, and if it were not repeated every year, and if the results of this intense labour were not so simple. To reap and bind the rye and oats, and to carry it, to mow the meadows, turn over the fallows, thresh the seed and sow the winter corn, all this seems so simple and ordinary. But to succeed in getting through it all, everyone in the village, from the old man to the young child, must toil incessantly for 3 or 4 weeks, 3 times as hard as usual, living on kvass, onions, and black bread, threshing and carrying the sheaves at night, and not giving more than 2 or 3 hours in the 24 to sleep. And every year this is done all over Russia. Having lived the greater part of his life in the country and in the closest relations with the peasants, Levin always felt in this busy time that he was infected by this general quickening of energy in the people. In the early morning he rode over to the first sowing of the rye and to the oats, which were being carted and stacked, and returning home at the time his wife and sister-in-law were getting up, he drank coffee with them and walked to the farm, where a new thrashing machine was to be set working to thresh the seed corn. He was standing in the cool granary, which was still fragrant with the leaves of the hazel branches interlaced on the freshly peeled aspen beams of the new thatch roof. He gazed through the open door, in which the dry, bitter dust of the threshing whirled and played, at the grass of the threshing floor in the sunlight, and the fresh straw that had been brought in from the barn, then at the speckle-headed, white-breasted swallows that flew chirping in under the roof, and fluttering their wings, settled in the crevices of the doorway, and then at the peasants, bustling in the dark, dusty barn, and he thought strange thoughts. "Why is it all being done?" he thought. "Why am I standing here, making them work? What are they all so busy for, trying to show their zeal before me? What is it that old Matryona, my old friend, is toiling for? I doctored her when the beam fell on her in the fire," he thought, looking at a thin old woman who was raking up the grain, moving painfully with her bare, sun-blackened feet over the uneven, rough floor. "Then she recovered, but today or tomorrow or in 10 years she won't. They'll bury her, and nothing will be left, either of her or of that pretty girl in the red skirt, who with that skilful, soft action shakes the ears out of their husks. They'll bury her and this piebald gelding. And very soon, too," he thought, gazing at the horse heavily breathing through dilated nostrils, its belly rising and falling as it trod the slanting wheel that turned under it. "And they'll bury her and Fyodor, who feeds the machine with his curly beard full of chaff and his shirt torn on his white shoulders. They'll bury him. He's untying the sheaves and giving orders and shouting to the women and quickly setting straight the strap on the moving wheel. And what's more, it's not them alone. Me they'll bury too, and nothing will be left. What's it all for?" He thought this, and at the same time looked at his watch to calculate how much they threshed in an hour. He wanted to know this, so as to judge by it the task to set for the day. "It'll soon be one, and they're only beginning the third sheaf," thought Levin. He went up to the man who was feeding the machine, and shouting over the roar of the machine, he told him to put it in more slowly. "You put in too much at a time, Fyodor. Do you see? It gets choked. That's why it isn't working well. Feed it evenly." Fyodor, black with the dust that clung to his moist face, shouted something in response, but still went on doing it as Levin didn't want him to. Levin, going up to the machine, moved Fyodor aside and began feeding the corn in himself. Working on till the peasant's dinner hour, which wasn't long in coming, he went out of the barn with Fyodor and started to talk with him, stopping beside a neat yellow sheaf of rye laid on the threshing floor for seed. Fyodor came from a village some distance from the one in which Levin had once allocated land to his cooperative association. Now it had been let to a former janitor. Levin talked to Fyodor about this land, and asked whether Platon, a well-to-do peasant of good character belonging to the same village, wouldn't take the land for the coming year.
"It's a high rent. It wouldn't pay Platon, Konstantin Dmitrievich," answered the peasant, picking the ears off his sweat-drenched shirt. "But how does Kirillov make it pay?" "Mitouch," so the peasant called the janitor in a tone of contempt. "You may be sure he'll make it pay, Konstantin Dmitrievich. He'll get his share, however he has to squeeze to get it. He's no mercy on a Christian. But Uncle Fokanich, so he called the old peasant Platon, do you suppose he'd flay the skin off a man? Where there's debt, he'll let anyone off, and he'll not wring the last kopeck out. He's that kind of man.
But why will he let anyone off?
Oh, well, of course, folks are different. One man lives for his own wants and nothing else, like Mitouch. He only thinks of filling his belly. But Fokanich is a righteous man. He lives for his soul. He remembers God.
How does he remember? How does he live for his soul? Levin almost shouted.
Why, to be sure, in truth. In God's way. Folks are different. Take you now. You wouldn't wrong a man.
Yes, yes. Goodbye, said Levin, breathless with excitement. And turning around, he took his stick and walked quickly away toward home. At the peasant's words that Fokanich lived for his soul, in truth, in God's way, undefined but significant ideas seemed to burst out as though they had been locked up, and all striving toward one goal, they thronged whirling through his head, blinding him with their light.